Council Jewish Women, Oral History 2. I'm Marlene Gelman with my partner Sarah Gorby. We are interviewing Mr. Joseph Saul on February 11, 1985 at the Anathan House. Mr. Saul, would you please give us your address?
It's 144 North Dietrich.
All right. Mr. Saul, would you please tell us about your early life?
See, I actually want to tell you not only about my early life, but the early life of our family, because while this is very characteristic of the people that came at that period. See, we were 8 children, and we lived in a town which had 9,000 Jews and 2,000 Gentiles, but actually it was a Jewish town. On Saturday, everything was closed, everything stopped, and the people were, of course, going to the synagogues, and you would think that you're in a Jewish city. But actually, it was under the Russian Tsar. Mm-hmm. Right outside of our city, there were 20,000 soldiers. And that was the industry of our town. See, the Jewish population supplied everything to the 20,000 soldiers. They needed the food, they needed the housing for the officers. The soldiers lived in barracks, mm-hmm. but the officers lived in private houses. And the private houses were supplied by the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. And this was okay. The characteristic of our town.
But well, can I ask you a question, Mr. What do you remember the name of the town?
The town is named Suwalki.
Can you spell that?
Suwalki.
And what year were you born?
I was born in 1902.
Okay.
See, and it's interesting that we have a world association of people that are coming from our town. Mm-hmm. And in New York City, there is a Landsmannschaft, an organization. And in October 1985, we are going to celebrate the 80th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And I was already invited to come. And we have also, in 40 different cities around the world, we have organizations of the people that came from our town. And one is in Tel Aviv. And when I came in Tel Aviv in 1960, the first time, I came first visiting my town in Poland, Russia. And of course, the people wanted to hear a report, and I gave them a report. And that's all we were doing is crying, because from the 9,500 Jews, only 7 Jews survived. All the others were killed off. And while for 40 years, I was dreaming of going back to our town, and when we came back to our town, we ran away the next morning because we couldn't take it.
Okay, let's go back to the town.
What?
Let's go back to the town.
Yeah.
You said the Jews supplied
everything
to the
to the 20,000 soldiers that was right on the German border.
Did the Jews grow the food?
No, they didn't grow the food.
No,
we were not farmers, but we were the suppliers and for the clothing. See, and the officers used to go to Jewish tailors to make to Jewish shoemakers and get the... Of course, there was a great cultural life in the town. See, there were 4 high schools, but the Jewish boys could not go to high school. See, only girls. In the girls' high schools, they admitted. See, I had 2 sisters, and both graduated high school, and one even graduated with a gold medal. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, she went to the Heidelberg University in Germany and to the St. Petersburg University in Russia. But boys were not admitted. And therefore,
why? What reason?
Because that's under the Tsar, there was discrimination. See, and they would not admit. So what could a Jewish boy do? Nothing. And the only thing what he could do is go to the United States.
Did you study the Torah and study religion?
Yeah, we studied
up to
the age of 14. But after 14, you want to prepare yourself for a world education, but you couldn't get it. So the only thing is, as soon as the kid was 14 years of age, and he had relatives in the United States, so he went to the United States.
What about your mother and father?
My father was an attorney, and he practiced and be at home for the eight children. But when my first brother was 14 years of age, see, my sisters were older, and they went to high school. But when my brother was in 1906, 14 years of age, my uncle in New York wrote him a letter, and he went to New York.
How did he become an attorney?
Because, see, he didn't go to school, but he took an exam, and they let him practice a limited way, and that's the way he made a living.
What did practicing attorney mean in that day?
Practicing attorney in our town meant that he was collecting, if a people were delinquent in paying the bills, he was collecting, and also collecting from the officers and the generals that didn't pay their bills, he used to go after them. And that was his profession.
And your mother?
My mother, of course, was the, we had a maid, and sure, with eight children, and a house. And of course, there was no bathroom, and there was no toilets, and you had to do the washing. And Friday, we used to make hot water and bring in the bathtub in the kitchen, and everybody was taking a bath.
Friday was bath day
because of
Shabbat.
Every Friday. And we used to take our bath.
Do you remember your house? What did it look like?
I remember it because I saw it 40 years later.
It was still there.
It's still there, but of course other people lived in it.
Can you describe it to us?
Well, it was a house. See, there were courts. See, you went into the court, and in the court there were many houses. And you walked in the first was the dining room, and there were three bedrooms and a kitchen.
And all one floor.
All on one floor.
Okay.
See, and next door there was the same.
Were they attached?
This was attached. Mm-hmm. And we considered ourselves well-to-do because we lived in a house.
Now you say you had a maid. What was the maid? Was it Russian?
She was Polish.
Polish. Okay. And she helped your mother.
Oh, sure. She did all the washing, and she did all the cleaning, and to wash for eight people, for 10 people.
How did they wash?
They brought in water from the outside, boiled the water, and that it was. It used to take a full day to do the washing, and take it outside and to hang it up, or take it on the second floor. There was a place where you could hang up, and that's the way. See, but in 1906, my first brother came to the United States, and afterwards in 1908, my second brother came, and he was 14. And in 1910, my third brother came, and he was 14. And in 1913, my fourth brother came. See, and we were ready to go, but the war broke out in 1914, and we couldn't keep any contact, and we were, 2 weeks after the war started, we were occupied by Germany. But it's interesting that in 1914, Germany was not what Germany was in 1933. When the Germans came into our town, we became very great friends, and we kept up the correspondence. Even after 1920, when we came to the United States, The Germans that stayed in our house when they came in kept the correspondence with us till 1933. And anything we needed, see, under the German occupation, they gave it to us. They gave us food. They gave us soup. Anything, and you can't imagine how friendly they were. And of course, they were very friendly with us because my sister was a graduate from a German university already in 1914, and therefore we all spoke German, and she was the head of the school that the Germans started in our town. See, and I don't know if you're familiar with the history of Pittsburgh. See, my sister came in 1920 to Pittsburgh.
What is your sister's name?
Zina Sol. See, and in 1921, the Council of Jewish Women gave her a job to help the refugee service. And my sister spoke many, many languages. And any refugee that came in from 1921 till the day she died in 1967, she could speak to them. See, I'll never forget my experience with Richard Carr. Richard Carr was the conductor of the Pittsburgh Symphony. He came to Pittsburgh in 1936. See, he came to New York and they sent him to Pittsburgh. He didn't speak a word of English. He didn't know anybody in Pittsburgh. But when he came to Pittsburgh, the next day, he went to the refugee service. And here a lady says to him, "Wo waren Sie gestern? Where were you yesterday?" He says, "Did you wait for me?" She says, "Yes. We knew that you're coming and we were waiting for you." And he could never forget it till the last day of his life that he came to a town where he didn't know anybody, to a community which he had no contact. And here a lady was sitting and waiting for him. And of course she got him the job with the Pittsburgh Symphony, and afterwards he became the conductor. See, and this was characteristics of the hundreds of the people that came to Pittsburgh. She helped 40 German doctors and dentists. They had to go to school before they could pass an exam. And for the year that they studied, they needed money. And she got people to loan them money and also after to be admitted to school, and afterwards they started to practice. And some of them became very, very outstanding doctors, not only in Pittsburgh, but in the United States. But the point that I want to make, that my brothers who came here in 1906, in 1908, in 1910, in 1913, they were only kids of 14, but the dedication and devotion to the family was so great that in 1920, we got a telegram that my third brother is coming to our town to bring us to the United States. And he brought the six of us, my two brothers and two sisters and my parents, and he brought us to Pittsburgh. And while they were not rich, they were just workers and young people, they rented a house for us on Nicholson Street in Squirrel Hill. As soon as we came, we didn't have to go through the hill. We didn't have to go through all, and right away we had Colonel Nicholson and Peter, 5900, a house from the first minute that we came, and anything we needed, furniture, anything we needed, we were just having. See, and after all, they left the family at the age of 14, but at the dedication of 40 years ago, later, and 12 years later, and 10 years later, and 7 years later, the dedication and devotion was so great that they borrowed money and everything just to see that the family should.
You didn't tell us how they came to Pittsburgh.
Well, because my brothers were in Pittsburgh.
Well, how'd your brothers?
Because we had relatives. I don't think if you know the Krieger, there were Krieger men's clothing on Fifth Avenue and afterwards our latest wholesale house on Penn Avenue. And they were my mother's first cousins. And they took my brothers and worked for them and even lived on Black Street in their house, and they send them to night school, and that's the way they were till they established themselves. And of course, when they brought us right away to Pittsburgh. See, now, my father was already 59 years old when he came here. He didn't speak a word of English. And it was very, very hard for him to find anything what to do. So the Beit Sholem Synagogue, of course my father went to the Beit Sholem Synagogue, they saw right away that he's a very intelligent person. Mm-hmm. And they gave him a job as a shamus. See, and he was the shamus from 1921 till 1951 when he died. See, and he made a very, very big success there. Everybody looked up to him. Though his English, he learned a little bit, but he was the one that originated to send notices. If you had your side, you're getting a notice now. He was the one that originated, because he had a beautiful handwriting, and he sent you a notice that...
See, what was your father's name?
Charles Soule.
Mm-hmm. Your mother?
Hannah Soule. Mm-hmm. But mother died in 1932.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of life did she have
here?
Well,
she didn't know... See, she was also 59 years old, and she couldn't go to school. But we had a lot of, it's interesting, we had a lot of relatives, and the relatives were very, very nice. See, and they were devoted, and they used to visit us almost 3-4 times a week. Mother had a sister, Mrs. Brody, and her son was Lou Brock Brody, who was connected with the temple. After he graduated Harvard, he became what's his name is now, who is the
executive director.
Director. He was the executive director, and that's his mother was my
mother's.
My mother's sister, and she had a lot of cousins, because my grandparents had many children, and most of them came to Pittsburgh, and they were all families, and everybody was very, very nice to us.
Were your grandparents living?
They died before 1910.
Before you came to Pittsburgh?
Oh, yeah, they died in our town.
What was life like in Pittsburgh? In Squirrel Hill?
Yeah, in Squirrel Hill, it was very interesting. For me, though we lived on Squirrel Hill, but I had no contact with Squirrel Hill, because I went first to Franklin School in the evening. I immediately got a job. See, as soon as I came, I didn't speak any English, and I went to work for a man by the name of J.J. Supper. See, we had a men's clothing store, and he come from my town, and therefore he gave me a job. But I didn't stay very long with him, because I belonged in Europe. I was planning to go to Israel, and we had a movement, which was called a Chalutz movement, to go to Israel. And out of the 200 kids, 199 went to Palestine in 1920, but since my brother came from Pittsburgh, he brought me to Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. But my interest was still Palestine and Israel, and therefore I got connected with the Pittsburgh labor Zionists, mm-hmm. and Harry Morgan and Mitchell Kaufman, who had a clothing store, were the leaders of the labor Zionist movement, and they gave me a job, and therefore I used to go in the morning to work, and in the evening, if I didn't go to Franklin School, I met all the kids on the hill, and we were, most of the time, we were on the hill. And of course, we spoke Yiddish.
And you, excuse me, you didn't tell us how old you were when you...
16.
When you came to Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr.
See, we were very much interested in Yiddish. See, while the Yiddish literature, see, the Hebrew literature is 2,000 years old. The Yiddish literature is only about over 100 years old. But in the 100 years that the Yiddish literature, it developed to be one of the great literatures of the world. And I suppose you know that Bashevis Singer got a Nobel Prize for the Yiddish literature. And while we have thousands of Yiddish writers in Poland, in Russia, in Lithuania, in Romania, in Mexico, in Argentina, in Brazil, in Australia, but we have only three Yiddish classics in the Yiddish literature. Mm. And the first one is Mendeley the Bookseller. He was born in 1935 and he died in 1917. The second is Peretz. He was born in 1959 and died in 1915. And the third one is Sholem Aleichem. You know, the Fiddler on the Roof. And he died in New York in 1916. It's exactly 125 years since he was born. While we were very much influenced by Yiddish literature, but there was one story which had the greatest influence on us. And the name of the story was Higher Than Heaven. And what is the story?
Let's stop right there.
The story is about a small town, and like in every small town where there's a Jewish population, only once a year, Jews go to midnight service. That's the Saturday night before Rosh Hashanah. And everybody went to the midnight service, except the rabbi. Where does the rabbi go? The rabbi goes to heaven. Because who is going to speak to God? There were so many poor and so many sick Jewish people in the town. And somebody has to speak to God about them. And therefore, the rabbi goes to speak to God in heaven. A young man came from a big town. And he heard that the rabbi goes to heaven. He says, what do you mean he goes to heaven? And he decided to find out what the rabbi does. And Saturday afternoon, he came into the house and he was hiding and watching. 11 o'clock at night, all the household got up and they went to the synagogue. And the rabbi remained home. When everybody left, the rabbi took off his rabbinical clothes, put on clothes of a peasant, took a hatchet, and he took a rope, and he left the house. Where is he going with a hatchet? And he was a little bit afraid, but he decided to follow him. And the rabbi went to a side street, and he came to a little forest. And when he came to the forest, he found a tree, and he broke it down, in pieces, put it on the rope, and he started to walk to town. When he came to a house, he knocked at the door, and a voice of a sick woman says, who is it there? He says, this is John from this and this village. I have some wood for sale. Poor, she says, I could use the wood, but I don't have any money. He says, don't worry, you'll pay me later. And he opened the door, and he put in the wood in the fire, and while the fire was burning, he was saying the prayers of the midnight service. And the next day, when the young man heard that the rabbi goes to heaven, he says, higher than heaven.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Beautiful.
See,
story.
This story and stories like this had a very, very great influence on us. And therefore, on the hill, while most of the people were very poor and had very limited income, we had a great cultural activities. And there was hardly a week that we did not bring a lecturer from New York, outstanding lectures on literature, on history, on the future of the Jews, on the different movement among the Jews. See, on Miller Street, on 35 Miller Street, was the Labor Lyceum. See, it was built in 1916, and it became a real cultural center. They had a school for children in Yiddish. See, and a lot of Yiddish kids, Jewish kids, learned Yiddish. Of course, it was an afternoon school. And in the evening, there were different organizations, like the Workmen's Circle, the Labor Zionist Organization, and also cultural organizations that used to meet and have courses either by local people, but the most important thing, that at least 30, 40 times a year, they used to bring very outstanding lectures on many things. And since the lecturers were bought, many of them, by the Labor Zionists, they used to come and spend time in the store with Mr. Morgan and with Mr. Kaufman. And therefore, we didn't pay any attention to our business. The most important thing was to discuss things with outsiders. And it was surely a very great time. We really felt that we had a great time spending such time. If a customer used to come in, we used to introduce him to the speaker and tell him all about it. Mm-hmm. And we never tried to sell him a suit while my father was a customer of mine for many, many years. But I never told him, come and buy something. But when he used to come in, we used to talk the different problems, and there surely was a lot of problems in those days. One of the problems was also in Russia. See, Russia in the early 20s, for the first time in the history of Russia, they gave the Jews a right to exist, to work, to go to school, to go to high school. And therefore, Jewish life in Russia was very interesting. But of course, in 1921, there was a big famine, and Mr. Hoover went to Russia to help them. And also, they needed a lot of help. And therefore, an organization started in the United States to help the Jews in Russia to become farmers. And we used to collect money, buy farm machinery, and send them to Russia. It was one of the outstanding organizations in Pittsburgh.
Did that have a name?
The name of the organization was Yiddishi Kolonizatsii Wislam. Yiddishi Kolonizatsii Wislam, Jewish colonization in Russia. And it happened that I was the secretary and the financial secretary, and we collected, in those days, if a person gave a dollar, it was a lot of money. See. And also, the Yiddish theater at that time was very, very popular in New York. And they were not only popular in New York, but they used to travel all over the United States. And in Pittsburgh, they used to come at least 10 different companies used to come a year, and they played the best place.
It's the art.